All right, welcome to the Influence of Art and Design. My name is Dan Rubin. I'll be the moderator, which on this panel means I'll be cutting people off when they decide that they're not going to stick to their time limits. Dave. Before we get into the introductions, I'd just like to thank you all for not going to the other inspiration and influence related panel that's going on right now by those no-name guys from No, we do. Rob and what's that other guy? Jason. They're great guys. We tried to sabotage their panel by giving Cameron Mall the flu, but they're still going to go on with two guys. But you'll be happier you came here. So we're going to just start with quick introductions down the panel, starting with Glenda at the end.
So my name is Glenda Sims, and I'm the good witch, and yet still a witch.
My name is Dave Shea, and I don't have anything clever to add like that.
My name's Eric Sagan. I'm better known as Cartooner. And yeah, that's it. Onto Anton.
Thank you, Eric. I'm Anton Peck, and nobody can follow Glenda. Yes.
As I said before, my name's Dan Rubin. Superfluous Banter is my blog. If you don't know what that is, yeah, it's all right. No one does. I'm very happy to have this great team of folks up here with me today.
I'm Patrick Haney, and I am not a sausage.
Yes. It's a great...
Thank you all, and good night.
It's the weirdest story I've ever heard.
He's going to use that line for the next 10 years.
Yes, I am.
All right, good. So I assume since you're all here, you already know kind of the overview of what we're talking about. You read it and you understand kind of what we're going to be talking about. I won't read verbatim the description that we put in the book. So let's just jump right to it. Glenda's going to start us off here.
Girls first.
Yes, girls first. And since we only have one, there you go.
There's no fighting. So unlike these boys, I'm not a web designer. I'm a system designer and a museum researcher at the Blanton Museum of Art here in Austin. And I had the great opportunity to work with curators and artists and museum visitors to create museum interactives, which I like to consider as avenues into art. And when we're working on something, what I'm trying to create is an opportunity for you to fall into a work of art. Just step in with your whole mind and body and soul so that the experience can literally change you. It's a lofty goal, but, you know, I like a good challenge. So in the type of work that I do with the museum, it is actually the art itself that influences my design. I literally, the work of art that is chosen for us to work with is the influence. And we add to that the artist, the historical context, etc. And the tools that I have on my tool belt as we work with these pieces include your old-fashioned audio guides, podcasts, rich media interactives on PDAs, websites, and when I'm lucky, location sensing or intelligent environments. It is a challenge, though, to me to make sure that any technology that we use is actually transparent and intuitive. Because while these toys are fun to use, I need to make sure I don't get between you and the work of art. Okay? So what I'm trying to do in museum research with curators is to actually determine, is the technology enhancing your experience in the museum, or is it distracting you? And I've literally been in situations where it was sad to see the children were sitting on the floor in the gallery with the handheld computer device with their back to the work of art. They looked a little bit like Sean Inman playing DS. Yeah. And the curators that I work with, we actually research to see if we're increasing critical observation and thinking skills and making personal connections. So what I'd like to do is tell you about a personal experience with a work of art that was just up there, Synecdoche. And When I was first shown this work of art, I saw it only in a digital format. So pretty much like you're looking at it right now, just the piece over there on the left. Something left, yeah. Glenda's directions are confused. And I saw it, and inside, you know, I'm in front of a curator, right? Inside, I'm laughing. I'm like, that's not art. My three-year-old could do this. It's paint chips from Home Depot, you know? And as I sat there with a curator, and she explained to me what it really was, it is 8.5 by 11 canvases, 20 of them, based on the skin tone of 20 humans on my campus, University of Texas at Austin campus. So those are 20 individual portraits. And if you had the audacity to take one off the wall and look behind it, their name is written on the back. They're in alphabetical order. So I can tell you even when it's upside down, because I know that the darkest person is Zoe, and she belongs in the bottom right-hand corner alphabetically. Now, why would somebody make a portrait this way? Well, have you ever been judged by your skin color alone? And at the point that this work was created, it was in response to affirmative action at the university, where it no longer became legal to use skin color for admission criteria. You can ask me more about that later. And so as we decided, how do I get you to fall into this piece? How do I get you to connect to this piece? The curator had this marvelous idea. She said, what if we asked you to stand in front of the piece and compare your skin tone to the work in front of you on the wall? And then on the handheld device that we gave you, you select which one of those squares is closest to your skin color. And then you, next slide, make it lighter or darker. Next slide. Submit it with your name, and we store it to our digital canvas. And you become a part of the work. That blew my mind. The way my favorite curator works. So this was one of the ways that we let people in to that work of art. And underneath this, what I'm really trying to do is change the culture of what you experience when you walk into an art museum. I want to transform the museum into your museum. I want it to be a place where you go and you play and you have fun. And I want to give you information to help you potentially make a personal connection and never, ever spoon-feed you with what you're supposed to think about this work of art. Because with all my heart, I believe that art is what you think it is. So what do you think, Dave?
Well, Glenda, I'm actually going to be talking about photography. And to get that started, I've got a photo I want to show you, and I want someone to tell me what this is. That's right. Thanks, Jason. It was the first photograph ever taken. This was taken in 1826 by a Frenchman named, you know, I'm not even going to try pronouncing his name. It was taken almost 200 years ago, which gives you kind of a context for how long we've had this medium. The early technological history of photography isn't really terribly interesting. The big challenges were actually getting exposure times down to the point where you could take a photo of a person without telling them to hold still for 8 hours. So around 1840, that was kind of possible, and around 1860, the first color photography was invented and came on the scene. Now, back then, they were kind of doing it a little differently than point-and-shoot. Back then, if you're aware of how Photoshop works with various color channels, they kind of did that with photography, where they'd put a colored screen over top of three different cameras and take a photo with those three different cameras and then combine them later, obviously not digitally. What's a little bit more interesting is the actual sociological impact of photography. And I'm actually just going to switch it into gratuitous visuals here instead of having slides, so you can enjoy that and look at that and not me. Since the inception of photography, it's been relatively controversial in the art world. When it first came out, of course, there was a lot of hyperbole. People were saying, well, this is it for painting. You know, we're done. No more portraits. We can just take photos instead. And to a certain degree, they were right. That was the main impact that painting or that photography had at that time. During the 20th century was when photography was actually starting to become accepted as a legitimate art form. When it first came out, there were various attempts to make it work as art, but it was seen as more a documentary sort of craft than an actual art form. And it was only during the early 20th century and later on that it began picking up as something that was accepted in galleries and by collectors. There's kind of two parallels to that. There was the art photography, which was obviously a bit of a struggle, and there was also the journalism photography or the documentary photography, which right from the beginning was clearly obvious how photography could benefit the journalism profession. It's only been relatively recently, like since the late 70s, that there have been photography-only galleries. I mean, that's in the history of the medium is actually still pretty recent. These days in art photography, there's a couple of trends that are happening. During the 70s, there was this thing called the snapshot aesthetic, which was basically just people going out with cameras and taking photos, and this kind of condescending term called photographers with or artists with cameras arose. And since that point, it's fell by the wayside, and these days it's more photography is more staged, and it makes use of specific lighting and basically taking the techniques of commercial photography and applying it to art photography is kind of the route that things are taking. Medium and large format cameras were once the cameras of choice for art photography. Now with the rise of digital SLRs and really high quality digital cameras, that's no longer true. But really the important thing here, I think, is that even now, at this point, the demand for actual fine art photography is still relatively non-existent. There really haven't been any major efforts made to popularize photography as an art form. Pretty much the most you're going to find is photography books. In the gallery system, it's gaining ground, but as a legitimate accepted art form, it's taken a lot of time. The actual prestige of calling something art photography has kind of led to spin-offs and things like cheap calendars and greeting cards and things like that, and calling those art. Well, it's not really. It's a commercial product. So photography as art has always had kind of a funny relationship. The most common kind of photography for any sort of purpose at all has been commercial photography. And this is actually the one that impacts us as designers the most. Commercial photography is really the form that we have the most exposure to, and it comes in a lot of different forms, whether that's advertising or editorial and photojournalism, fashion and glamour photos, wedding photos, things like that. So these days, the trends with commercial photography are kind of interesting to follow, especially for me as a designer. You know, we've noticed that as digital cameras have become more and more prevalent, film is slowly going the way of the dinosaur. I think it was Kodak recently who just kind of shut down their actual film division, and I mean, they're just joining others. So it's digital is basically the way forward from this point. And at the same time, as digital cameras get better, so the costs go down at the same time. And we're kind of at this point right now where the amount of quality camera you can buy for a relatively low price is really way better than it has been in the past. You know, I can go out and I can get a professional camera for less than $1,000, which is really leading to some interesting things. I mean, if you take a look at Flickr, a lot of the top users on Flickr are using digital SLRs, and I think the top 10 cameras on Flickr are all digital SLRs, which means that most of the photography going through that site is quality photography, or at least Coming from quality cameras, it's obviously the photographer that makes the picture. So maybe that's not the best way to put it. But what I think that's really important and what that's kind of indicating is that there's this trend for amateur photography. And right now, people who normally in the past may not have been taking so many photos have access to some really professional gear, and you're seeing a lot more people taking a lot more interesting pictures. And I think the area where this has had the biggest impact is actually stock photography. And, you know, like, say, 30 years ago, you had stock providers who would sell you and license you photos for use in your design work for hundreds or thousands, or depending on your usage, a lot more than that. And these days, you know, I can go on Flickr and I can offer somebody $50 to use their photo, and I can use it wherever I want, depending on, you know, what kind of license I work out with them. Or I can go to a site like iStock Photo, which is also run by amateurs, and it involves amateur photography, and I can get some high-quality photography. So for me as a designer, it's really interesting to see this change in commercial photography and how it's moving more towards mass quantities where the quality may not be as good, but a lot of the time it's good enough. And I could keep going, but I think I'm going to pass it over to you now, Eric.
Thank you. All right, so I'm here today to talk to you about pop culture.
Watch it right there, dude.
Yeah, I know. So what is pop culture? If you ask different people, you're going to get different answers. And I'm going to start out with a quote here by Oscar Wilde, one of my favorite quotes. The artist should never try to be popular. Rather, the public should be more artistic. What pop culture is, it's really a culture of the masses. It's comprised of many elements. Can be literature, cooking, consumption, mass media, toys. The list goes on and on. So at any point in time, it could be Emeril Bam Lagasse. Cha-cha-cha-chia pet. Queen Elizabeth, Elton John, and again, the list goes on and on. So pop culture can also reflect and influence a way of life. Now, two aspects of pop culture that I'm going to focus in on today are art and film. And I consider art and film an endless source of creativity. And I put them under a label, mainstream imagination. So to begin with, I'll talk about pop art. During the 1950s, an art movement emerged from Britain and the United States. And this art movement was called pop art. There were many artists at the time who trailblazed their way to celebrity, including Jasper Johns and his use of abstract art. Images, he created images of like found objects from pop culture. So he has one in particular of an American flag where he then overlays paint on top of. And then there's also the famously known Andy Warhol. And I'm sure many of you have seen his portraits. He was a former advertising illustrator who segued into becoming a pop culture artist. And he's most famously known for his silkscreen multicolored pop art, including Campbell's soup cans and Marilyn Monroe. Now, there was one artist in particular at the time in that era, named Roy Lichtenstein, who decided it would be really interesting to emulate a comic book art style. And so what he did is he would use these bold strokes, stylized characters, and these art pieces looked as if they were extracted from the comic books of that time. And to finalize it, he used a Ben Day screen, actually named after a gentleman named Ben Day, who created the screen process in 1879. And what it is, it's essentially a stencil that mimics a newsprint look or a halftone pattern. This is one of his most famous pieces called The Drowning Girl. Now, it depicts a, well, it depicts a drowning girl. And
that's deep.
Yeah, it is. Thank you.
And if you that's why she's drowning.
Yes, yes. And what's so interesting about this piece and what's so fascinating about this piece is the way Lichtenstein decided to close in on his subject, the drowning girl. And the caption reads, "I don't care, I'd rather sink than call Brad for help." Which to me tells me she's either too proud or she just has an issue with Brad. I don't know who Brad is, but she definitely doesn't like him. But this particular piece tells a story, and you really get this sense, this claustrophobic feeling when you look at it, and it really evokes a heightened suspense of reality and whatnot. And she's crying, so. Moving on. This piece is called Wham. Yes, it's appropriately named.
We have a new panel member.
And this is another one of his famous pieces because it just, when you look at it, it's just showing a lot of action there. And, I mean, as a kid growing up, you love to see scenes like this. And one of my favorite movies is Top Gun. This reminds me a lot of it. And World War II film reels. So the use of color in here is just amazing, too, as well. So it's very stylized. Now, there's another more recent pop culture artist named Tom Wilson. And he's better known as Biff from the Back to the Future movies. Talk about a guy who started out as just a movie star and now does pop art. That is really cool. So his art evokes feelings of nostalgia because he focuses in on objects from childhood. And so he paints these wonderful paintings of, like, Wooly Willy. I'm sure all of you know who that is. You could take the magnetic chips and create beards and cool mohawks and all sorts of hairdos. As well as Rock'em Sock'em Robots. Like, who would not want that hanging on their wall? What's amazing about this piece, too, is just the use of color. It uses the primary colors, but it's also very stylized and simplistic. So when you're looking at it, it puts you in that moment. And I implore you to do this. Taking these things into account, and when you're sitting there and you're staring at a blank page, or staring at a blank screen for that matter, try a couple things. What you might want to do is, if you don't have the source material right there in front of you, if you can't convince your friends and family to dress up as pirates, like I couldn't do recently, you might just pop in a DVD. So, for example, recently I had to do some sketches of some pirates for a webcomic I'm working on. And I just popped in a copy of Pirates of the Caribbean. And I would freeze frame it and just sketch. And depending on what you need, let's say you want a James Bond looking guy, put in a James Bond movie. Freeze frame it, sketch from there. Another technique you might consider is just going down to a local art museum.
That's a great idea.
Yes. And and or a just an art, like a museum just with, I don't know, woolly mammoths. It doesn't matter. Anything. But take a notepad with you. And when you're looking at these art pieces, jot down a few things. Jot down how you feel when you're looking at them. What emotions do you feel? What elements did the artist choose to focus on instead of others? And what you'll find is you will have amassed a source, a limitless pool of information that you can apply to your own artwork. So the next time you're staring at that blank screen or that blank piece of paper, something will magically, and I say magically, emphasize magically, will manifest itself in front of you. And you'll find that that creativity was in you the entire time. And it's thanks to people like you, the people in this room right now, that the world is continuously becoming a more beautiful place. And I say that with sincerity. Pass it on to Anton.
Very impressive.
I'm inspired.
Well, I'm going to start with a quote also, once I get there, of Michelangelo. He did say, I saw an angel in the marble and carved until I set him free. I think that can have a lot of meaning, probably a lot deeper than what it meant for him and possibly how it can apply to us. When we start with a blank idea and we want to try to discover something within it. And one of the things we've talked about so far is different types of media, be it photography, or pop culture, paintings, artwork in a museum. It's all different types of media. We all, as artists and designers, when we come up with our ideas and we want to try to convey them in some fashion. We're starting with a blank slate, regardless of what that medium is. Michelangelo started with marble. These days, it might be something entirely different. The actual definition of medium, as per Wikipedia, which... Right. That's up to debate. In the arts, media are the materials and techniques used by an artist to produce a work. And I think that applies to probably more people than just artists. It's anytime you have an idea and you want to start with something, what you're starting with and the tools that you use are the media. I had come across a photograph. And sometimes when I'm looking at photographs, I can see different things. And that sort of goes back to that quote that Michelangelo had of seeing something and letting it free. Now, I'm certainly not a Michelangelo. Nobody really is these days. But the idea still stands that you can look at something and create something beyond that. And when I saw this one, I saw more than just a bird. I looked at the wing and wing specifically and saw something beyond that. And it sort of evolved into that. I won't necessarily go into techniques or whatever, but and it's the idea of going from...
It's more magic.
Seeing, yeah, not entirely. But I think it had a little bit to do with Photoshop. But there is the point that Photoshop was my medium, starting with a digital photograph. So be it Photoshop with a digital photograph or how Michelangelo started with the marble, I think it's something that we can all apply in our own work somehow when we use our resources and try to just let the inspiration lead us into what it wants to be and let it out. And with that, I'm going to hand it off to Dan.
Well, thank you, Anton. So we've talked about various visual mediums, visual forms of what we call art. But something that I know is very, very important to most designers, I'm assuming that most of you in the room are either designers already or aspire to be designers if you're here. Influence and inspiration are things that are very hard to come by. And I'm just a quick show of hands, how many of you who are designers listen to music while you work, including the panelists? Right. Pretty sure everybody on the panel. Okay, so pretty much all of us. All right, and you find that it helps in some way, either gets you into a zone, just blocks out all other distractions, various other things. But there's much more to it. And my goal here is just to get you thinking about the way music influences your creative process a little bit more. I asked the panelists a few questions. How does music influence you? Do you listen to music while you work? You know, everybody does. And are there specific types of music you listen to for, you know, maybe specific types of design work? You know, for how does music influence you? You know, you get it affects your productivity, working pace. It can affect your mood. It can trigger memories. You know, all these things can really help, whether that's for your design or just in general. Obviously, we all listen to music while we work. There are a lot of reasons why. But when I got to the question about the specific types of music influence the types of work that you do, everybody on the panel answered no, which I found curious. So I dug into it a little bit more. And if we look at the power behind music, I think it's tough to deny that music has major physiological and psychological effects on us. We know it does in certain ways. If you're at a club, they don't play, you know, really slow dance music. They play, you know, very fast, loud, powerful rhythms because that gets your heartbeat up, it gets your heart rate up, raises your blood pressure. You know, there are physical changes that happen just by listening to that, and that encourages that energy that you use to dance. And it works in the opposite way, too. If you're going to relax and chill out, you don't typically listen to very, very high-energy music because it has the opposite effect. Same as color affects you. There's musical color and rhythmic color can affect you in that same way. So that takes us to the concept of... Oops, that was supposed to be my second one there. Planning. So I pose to you that music and art have this symbiotic relationship. Based on the answer to that third question of the panel, and I guess most of you probably feel the same way, that you have your music that you listen to while you create whatever you create, but you don't necessarily feel like there's a direct connection between that music and what you're creating or your style. Definitely everybody up here, they're very talented artists, but everybody answered immediately, no, it doesn't affect what I do. But I think if you think about it a little bit, it does. If you look through, just very briefly, think about this stuff. The Impressionist period. All right, you've got artists like Monet and Renoir. Very beautiful works of art that were created. And the music that was being created at the same time by the likes of Debussy, Ravel. Go home and pull it up on iTunes, find it online, whatever. Listen to some of those works from the Impressionist period. And at the same time, look at some of the visual works that were created. They feel like they go together. Fast forward a little bit, and you get to works like those of Jackson Pollock. Now, it's known that he listened to jazz while he was creating his works. There's actually a CD out there if you want to go look for it. Jackson Pollock Jazz. Probably very hard to come by. You might actually have to find it in LP form, but it's actual selections that he did listen to while he created. And you listen to these pieces while looking at his art that was created in the same time period, and they just, you can see where that energy came from. Now, here's the interesting thing. Reverse them. Go through, listen to some Debussy, and look at the works of Jackson Pollock. They don't match. They don't fit. There's a dissonance there. Dissonance is a good musical term, but it's also a good artistic term. Flip it around. Listen to the jazz, the high-energy jazz and bebop-style music that Jackson Pollock was listening to while creating works like this, and look at some of the works of Monet and Renoir. It doesn't match up, does it? I mean, you could force connections if you wanted to, but really, it doesn't feel right. Now, think about that with your own work. I think if you start to look at the music you listen to, the energy that's in that music, and what you're actually creating while you're listening to it, there is a direct connection. You don't think about it because it is a subconscious connection, but I guarantee you that, let's say Anton, we had that wonderful piece of art up before. What music do you like to listen to the most while you're creating, Anton?
While I'm creating?
Yes.
It tends to be sort of a high-energy trance, like techno kind of stuff.
I know you're a big fan of Massive Attack.
Yeah.
And Anton got me turned on to Massive Attack as well. Very high-energy, trip-hop, trance, there's a feel to it. And, when I look at Anton's work, I feel that. If I forced Anton to listen to country music...
I would hurt you.
And I'm just pulling that out of the air. If to a style that's very, very different from what he likes to listen to, and if that was the only style of music he could listen to, he couldn't turn it off. He had to listen to it. It was going to replace his Massive Attack stuff. I guarantee you his style would be different. It would also alter his pace of work. It would alter his mood. Because it... I think that's pretty clear. And I'm pretty sure I see a lot of heads nodding here. The same thing would happen to you. If I replaced your music... And this is a good exercise, too, just to get a further understanding about that subconscious influence that music and everything else has on you while you design and while you create. Take yourself out of your comfort zone. Take yourself out of your normal element and listen to something that you're not used to and see the difference that it has. It might actually inspire you to do work that you're not used to doing. It might get you out of a rut. If you're hitting a creative block, change parts of your environment. That includes that music. Music is a big comfort zone for us. Think about that. Think about that dissonance. Which brings us just to a quick summary of how music affects you. We know that it affects our mood, our emotion. Okay, the physiological effects, the psychological effects, it's pretty hard to deny. There's lots and lots of research that confirms it, and you pretty much all know it. Is there anybody here who doesn't believe that that music has a very, 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 very strong psychological and physiological effects? Anybody? No. Didn't figure. So, as an exercise, when you go home, try a couple of these things. Switch up the music you listen to. See what it does to you. Actually force yourself. Go and listen to some of those examples that I gave of different types of music, different eras of music, and the types of visual art that were created in those same periods, and then mix and match them and just see what that dissonance does to you. You might actually find some further inspiration there. Basically, before I hand it over to Pat to tie all this stuff up nicely and neatly, the next time you put your headphones on to do some work, seriously think before you hit play about what's on your playlist and what you're about to create, and start thinking about how appropriate what you're listening to is to the style that you're trying to create visually, because changing that up will, I think, improve what you create, and it'll expand your visual horizons by expanding what you're listening to. So, speaking of visuals, want to give us some nice ones, Pat?
All right, so as the last person on the panel, my job is to tie everything together and do it in -6 minutes. And fortunately, I didn't bring my time machine, so I'm just going to try to get through this. So I'm a web designer, and I tend to get inspiration from the web a lot, but I also get inspiration from other places. I don't know if anybody's seen it, but I have a set on Flickr for my inspiration screenshots, which I started as a personal project, and apparently everybody else wants to see what I have to say or show, so it's kind of become a little bit popular. And I'm going to go through a couple screenshots that I really, really enjoyed. This one right here is Alex Ducal, and he's an illustrator, and I just really like the way that he is displaying his illustrative work boldly, largely on this page and on his site. And it's really all about his art here. You kind of forget that you're at a website. You're looking at almost like a gallery of his illustrative works. Rick Catlow, also a very interesting artist, and he incorporated his artwork into his site as well. And this is probably one of my favorite sites recently. This is the Joyent site. This illustrative work was originally done by an illustrator named Paige Pooler, and she created the Jill, who you see at the header there. And Joyent took that, and they really kind of made the site around the illustrative work, and yet they have nothing to do with illustration or artwork, for that matter. And I just thought that was really quite interesting, because they kind of built the site around something they're not even selling. This is the National Gazette site. I really like this site because it's kind of tying in the newspaper feel. If anybody has seen Cameron Mull talk, you've probably seen this before. But it's really based on the typography, a little bit of imagery for each of the articles. But it's laid out sort of like a newspaper, and it kind of just gives you the feeling that you're actually reading a very nice newspaper-like piece of paper. And I really enjoy the way that's tied together. Now, I'm going to get into a little bit of how art actually influences web design or other sorts of design. This is actually a piece of a stained glass window at Mallet Hall in Notre Dame. It's part of a much larger piece. I don't have an image of that larger piece. But what they did was the Department of Theology took that piece of stained glass art and they tied it into their site. Now, this is the site Grayscale. And I just want to show you the progression here. So now, if we show the image of the art with its color, you can see how the actual site's color scheme is directly influenced by that one piece of art. And I just thought that was really, really well done, and it's a great-looking site. So I don't know if anybody's seen this site before. It's mezzoblue.com. Dave, have you seen this one?
No, it's not familiar. Right.
Dave didn't actually know this was going to be in here until about an hour ago. So, Dave actually took some of his photography and tied it directly into his site as well. He puts an image in the header and then creates a color scheme based on that image. And he's got a couple variations so far. This is another one I really enjoyed. And then this one as well. So it's directly related to the photography that he does. This is a piece by Joseph Albers, and it's hanging in the George Eastman building of the Rochester Institute of Technology. where I went to school. And this is a clock called Timeless Equilibrium, and that's in the Student Alumni Union at RIT. And so when I was creating a site when I worked at RIT for Art on Campus, which was a site basically displaying all of the artwork on the campus at RIT, I had to tie in some of the artwork. And so I decided to actually use the artwork around the site into the actual site, as well as display the artwork and talk about it. This is a Frank Gehry building. It's at MIT. It's called the Strata Center. And I find that architecture, while not even related to what I do or even influencing what I do, inspires me to actually create. I find myself walking by this building all the time thinking, oh, it's really cool. I want to go back and create something cool. Nothing to do with this building, but it just inspires me to actually do something. And this is a great quote by Margot Chase. To me, graphic design seems like something that's built the same way. At the bottom is passion for making of the thing, not the money or the recognition it will get you. And I thought that was a great tie-in to architecture and design. And this is a poster by Bruce Terkel. It's obviously inspired by the 70s. He created it for, I think, a partnership for Drug-Free America. And I thought that was great. You're relying on a poster to keep your kids off drugs. What are you, high? It's just like, it just made me laugh, but at the same time, it makes a good point. It was created basically to get the attention of parents who grew up in the 70s, might have used drugs, and just don't want to talk to their kids about drugs because they might feel embarrassed. But, I mean, I thought this would grab their attention immediately, and it just gets the message across right away. But it's well inspired by the 70s, obviously. So, inspiration, influence, design, I take it from all over the place. I get inspired by architecture. I get inspired by paint, by sketching, by the web, obviously. I take it from all over the place, and I don't think you should necessarily limit yourself to whatever your specific design area is. And this is another quote. Donald Young, if I design a logo, remember, it does not come from out of my head as original idea. The design references in some manner something that I've seen before. And I thought that was a great quote because you're always somewhat inspired by something you've seen because your life is full of experiences that you've gone through. And obviously, when you create something, you have to be pulling something from somewhere else that you've seen when you create it. And that's just what human beings do. When I created this logo, and this is the Refresh logo that will hopefully be on Refreshing Cities at some point, I found myself being influenced by my own work. And I think people sometimes forget, when you do mock-ups for design or whatever design you're doing or sketches, you should consider the work that you're doing influencing the work that's the final product. And here you can see some of the sketches I did early. And then I changed some things, and eventually I came to the final logo. So you should always consider your own work as influencing your new work. Maybe even go back to look at some things you've done in the past that aren't even necessarily the same thing that you're working on right now, and just take a look at what you did before. Maybe you'll get some ideas on how to inspire yourself for what you're doing now. If you haven't seen this before, you need to get out more. This is Starry Night by Van Gogh. This is my favorite painting. I have a very large print of it hanging above my bed, and I have a very small print of it hanging above my computer at work. And I sometimes just look at this for two things. One thing I look at it for is to calm me down. It's very calming. The color, just the broad strokes. And that sets a mood for me so I can maybe get in a mood to design. Other times, I find myself looking at it to get me fired up. Because if you look at Van Gogh's work, and if you really get close to Van Gogh's work, if you've ever seen it in a museum, you can see the passion that he painted with. Very large strokes, very swooping. I just find myself really, really pulled in by his work. So this is one of the things that I use to get myself either in the mood or really passionate about something. And then I'm going to finish up with this book. I found this book really, really useful. It's called Inspirability. It's basically one person's interviews with 40 different designers in different parts of design, just asking them what inspires them, similar to what this panel is about. And they have really great answers. There's parts, they show some of their work, and there is a piece of paper that had some questions on it, and each person, each designer filled this out, and there is a photocopy of that in the book for each person, and it's really, really quite interesting to read some of the things in there. And the quotes that I pulled are actually both from that book. But I read this book front to back in a day, and I definitely want to read it again. And besides, you can't go wrong. It's green and fuzzy. You should definitely pick up a copy. So hopefully I pulled all of that together, and I'm going to hand it off to Dan now.
Thanks, Pat. Good job. Inspirability is probably safe. It's safe to say it's the fuzziest book I own.
I agree.
It's definitely worth getting. I'm looking at the clock here. We're going to run a little long, but we're running into the lunch hour. So if you're willing to stay an extra 5 to 10 minutes or so for like the Q&A at the end of it, that's cool too. I'm going to have a couple of books to give away, so it's worth staying if you want some. And we're also going to, I'll mention it now, so those of you who want to stay will know about it. We're going to head to lunch. We'll let you know where we're heading once we're done here. Though there probably won't be room for all of us, we want to invite anybody who wants to kind of follow us along and just continue the discussion and come up and talk with us after, you know, at lunch. Please come along. So stick around to hear where we're going. We're going to have a quick group discussion. I want to ask a couple of questions to the panel to get everybody thinking. So let's get right into it. Everybody, feel free to answer rather than let the crickets speak for you. Which particular art forms do you feel lead to the most inspiration?
I'm going to have to say Thomas Kinkade paintings are probably my number one.
I know you're kidding.
You finally figured it out.
I figured it out. I'm kidding.
I'm actually going to take a cheap way out and say that the printed medium is probably my most where I get most of my inspiration from. I am a sucker for going to the design bookstore. We've got a few specialty stores around town, and just flipping through and looking at not necessarily work. I really hate looking at websites on the printed page, so I generally try to look at more traditional design work, stuff done for other mediums, photography books, design books, things like that. And that's generally where, if I know I'm stuck on something, I like to take a break and just kind of walk over to the bookstore or, you know, flip through a magazine or something like that, and just try to refresh my brain by looking at what other people have done.
Anybody else?
Crickets. Yes.
The crickets are chirping.
Do it, Eric.
All right. I'm most inspired by illustration work. I mean, I can look at that stuff for hours on end, and there are a lot of awesome illustrators on the web right now, including like John Martz, and list goes on and on. I cannot name like all of them because my brain is just not that vast. And also for me, I come from an oil landscape painter, just paintings in particular just inspire me. Just looking at the Van Goghs, the Renoirs, just endless. I can look at those for hours as well, and they just kind of draw you in, depending on the mood you're in. And that's it. Anton?
I was just going to mention that one of the resources I find inspiration from sometimes that is kind of an unexpected one is tattoos, you know, tattoo shops and tattoo art. There's a lot of books out there on that, and it's really, some of the line work is just incredible.
That's awesome. I'm actually with Dave. Print is actually probably my biggest inspiration, even though I have this huge Flickr set. I find myself going to bookstores all the time and grabbing a design book and just looking through it. And like him, I don't like looking at websites on printed page either, so I usually go for traditional or magazines and that newspapers and all sorts of other type of medium, and just taking a look at what people have done with it and how typography works into it.
And I like looking to architecture for design inspiration. I love that Gary example that Pat had, and I also, Glenda took us on a tour of the Blanton yesterday, and when you walk in there, the building is a piece of art. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's amazing, and the way that light plays with everything in that building is just, it's just incredible. I recommend, while you're here, if you haven't gone to it, go. It's definitely worth it. And I have stacks of architecture magazines that, when I'm just looking for shapes and colors and lines and feelings and moods, it can be a wonderful source. And I don't find that a lot of graphic designers actually think about using that. You can go out, just go outside and look around. I live in South Florida, so I also get a lot of bright colors when I step outside my door, which just is very, very useful. But, you know, look at what's around you. It can be a wonderful source of inspiration.
Dan?
Yes?
I was going to say one of my favorite things.
You're not an artist.
It's all right.
I'm kidding. We're all friends up here, even though it doesn't seem like it.
I'll tackle him later.
Not anymore. Go ahead.
One of my favorite things is art you can get inside. We have two works of art that you can physically step inside at the Blanton Museum, and those are my favorite for personally finding inspiration. And there's one, literally, I've probably been inside it 20 times. It still bowls me over every time I'm in there. When it comes to the actual work that I do, creating interactives for art, what I look for is the work of art that seems the most ridiculous in the museum. So if you go to the Blanton, there's a pink like hexagon that looks like a tablecloth just tacked onto the wall. I like those because they're the hardest to do something interactive.
Nice. Mr. Hicks, do you have anything to add?
He's into 2D, and yeah.
I think he likes cheese. That's what I've heard.
I actually, Dan, when Patrick was talking and mentioned typography, that actually triggered something. We had discussed in our kind of prep for this panel movie introduction typography and the clips that happen at the beginning of movies. And, you know, some that I can think of off the top of my head are like Catch Me If You Can, Spider-Man. Thank you for smoking. And this is all stuff you can actually find on YouTube, but there's just some fantastic type treatments. I'm sure everybody here has probably seen the one going around recently that takes Pulp Fiction dialogue, and yeah, I see a lot of nodding heads, so you know what I'm talking about. But, you know, check on YouTube. But the type treatments are just really great for my own type work and just new ideas and that sort of thing.
Awesome. One more question that I'll ask before we go to questions for the room. Get your questions ready. See that microphone right in the middle of the room? That's where you need to get to, so don't jump all over each other to get there. So one more question for the group. What is your dream design project? I love this. This is Glenda's question, and it's awesome. What is your dream design project, and how do you see art influencing it? Drum roll, please.
Wow, that's an amazing question. I would have to say, for me, working on a film and doing some sort of storyboarding, that would be awesome. And, of course, I just love sketching. So being a part of that creative process would just be a dream job for me. So, yeah.
I would actually say designing a house. I've always wanted to actually own a house and be able to play with the spaces. And I think that would really be great because you'd be able to work with art influencing separate rooms. I'd like to play with space, light, and I think the art would definitely play into that in a big way.
I think being the next digital Bob Ross would be cool.
That would be great. Do your Bob Ross voice. Come on. Do it.
Do it.
Do it.
The happy little trees.
Yes.
I kind of have a weird left brain, right brain thing going on, so I prefer projects that have a lot of technical side as well as design side. So for me, the ultimate thing would be not having clients and just being able to work on my own stuff and being able to build some really cool stuff that kind of was, you know, as design-oriented as it possibly could be, but required a bunch of technical tinkering and things like that. So that would be great. And get paid for that. That'd be cool.
My favorite project would be to take what Google Books is doing and do it for art so that we could actually access any art that we need digitally, and also with kind of a Flickr-like flavor to it, and a music plasma. So just that little project.
Great. Let's put a Santa hat on Michelangelo's sculptures.
We can do that.
That's a Flickr feature.
It's all downhill. And it might... My kind of dream project is kind of similar to Pat's furniture design. Always something. Furniture is another place. Like architecture, I get a lot of inspiration from furniture. It might sound weird, but I just have a.
That's going to make for great questions later.
There's just a thing about it. It's certain design styles, but just seeing how things go together and the thought process that goes into it, and I think you can see a lot in a lot of furniture design, especially modern design. You can see a lot of direct influence from contemporary artistic styles, but I would love to work on furniture and architecture. I think I'd do both. I'm going to build a house and build all the furniture that goes in it.
Y'all could work together.
I think I'm going to do that.
I'm not coming over.
You won't be invited, so that's...
questions. Time for questions.
Yep, Q&A. Hit us up.
Yeah. An interesting quote I heard from the designer of the Furby about design and art is that art is the experimental end of design. I wonder if there are any examples of experimental web design things or... from arts that have translated into kind of everyday web design practices. And also I found that comment by Shay that photography has had a hard time as a fine art curious because going to museums, every museum I see or significant museum has a photography exhibit. Is that just fake art to draw the general public in?
Glenda?
Glenda?
Photography is definitely not as large as the other types of collections. So, and there are specific photography museums where that's different. But for example, I think we have next to 5% out of our collection is photography.
Yeah, there's oddly no photography in the British Museum. I'm not sure why. Mm-hmm. The first part of that question was.
Experimental.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the early days of the web was where we saw a lot of the really experimental stuff, especially when, you know, Flash first came on the scene.
Yeah.
These days the focus is definitely more on the practical side of things. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean there's not a whole lot of experimental stuff out there. You know, I've seen some really interesting CSS playgrounds, for example, really kind of wild out there effects that you'd never use on a project, like building pictures with CSS borders and things like that. You know, it's not practical, but it's something you can do, so why not do it? So the spirit is alive, but maybe a little bit more subdued these days since the focus has shifted a bit.
Next question.
My question is a little bit unusual. There's one source of inspiration that lots of artists have used over the years that hasn't been mentioned, and that's drugs. I just wondered whether the panel thought using drugs for inspiration was cheating or what other comments.
It depends on how you define drugs.
That was the other panel that Jason and Rob were running.
Yeah. Yep.
After the cream.
That was love.
The reason I ask is my aunt is an art teacher, and one of her greatest students was this guy who used to paint these amazing pictures, and he was just always high, and it was just an interesting, is that cheating? I'm curious to hear what people think.
I wouldn't say it was cheating. I would just say it was dangerous, and that I think when it comes to drugs, perhaps what that is breaking down all the barriers and letting yourself and your soul come out. So if it takes drugs to do that, I'm sorry, and I would challenge you to try and break through with that.
Well, who here watches the show Heroes?
You stole my line.
Isaac Mendez. That's all I have to say about that.
Yeah. Well, it's drugs or alcohol, anything that I perform on stage. I'm a singer as well as a designer, and it's a discussion that comes up a lot with singers and stage performers that, you know, a lot of people have stage fright, and the way a lot of there are two ways to battle it. You can fight it head on and just deal with it, and over time you can figure out how to use it to your advantage. Or you can, you know, have, you know, a drink before you go on stage. Or there are a lot of beta blockers that.
Oh, are we not supposed to do that?
That would explain a lot.
Mimosas.
It's the same thing. It's figuring out, as Glenda said, it's really about breaking down the barriers. And you can do it yourself. It just might take longer, but the rewards are much greater. And chances are, if you figure out those keys to yourself to unlocking those that inspiration, that creativity, rather, in yourself, you'll have a much more rewarding and a much longer career. Drugs are probably great for a brief but exceptional career. Well, it's all about, as you said, there's calming nerves and there's, you know, hallucinations. But it is really about, it's all about here. That's what it's about. I think you can find sources of inspiration in other places. Now, granted, there's probably a lot of absolutely amazing art, the same as absolutely amazing music and writing that's happened over the years that would not have happened without drugs. So, is it cheating? No. Would I do it? No. Would they do it? Probably.
Are y'all still friends?
Next question. Oh, yeah, we're great. Yeah, we're still going to lunch, but it's going to be at six different places. Next question.
With regard to inspiration, I thought your mention of the tie between music and art was extremely interesting. The first thing I want to know is, do you know of any studies that mention the thing about tying specific artists to type of music, or was that just an exercise? I found that fascinating. And the second question is, what role does silence play in inspiration? As a programmer, I work best when it's totally silent. So I'm curious about the role of silence in that context that we were discussing.
Good questions. The first one about studies and stuff, I was trying to do a lot of research for specific studies about that and was not actually able to find much. I've done a certain amount of studies in the past on music therapy, so I know a lot. There's a lot to be found there about especially the physiological and psychological connections, just the effects that music, different types of music, have on the brain and on the body, because there are very, very direct connections. But I had a hard time finding any studies that seem to be done directly making that connection between art. But there are examples like with Pollock and I kind of extrapolated that myself, and you can find those connections. And the more you start talking to people about the styles of music that they listen to while they create, you can find those parallels. So I think it's a good just research project for all of you.
Good answer. And
as a possibility, celebrities are starting to publish their playlists, yeah. So that might be a starting point.
Definitely,
and
definitely.
I'd like to hear about the silence.
Oh, yes, and silence, very quickly, just from a music point of view, who's heard of John Cage? Okay, if you haven't, go look him up. Wikipedia has actually a good write-up on John Cage. One of the pieces, he was just very experimental music, and a lot of musicians that I know don't think of it as music, but it is. One of the pieces he created, 4 minutes and 33 seconds, it was probably his most popular piece. It's a pianist comes out on stage, sits down at the piano, and doesn't do a thing. Sits there for 4 minutes and 33 seconds. It's the length of time. It's technically, it's not silence, actually. It's music that's created ambiently by the audience, when you're kind of nervous, twitching, and people jingling keys in their pockets and things. And it's music because it has a meter. It has a length. It's 4 minutes and 33 seconds is the exact length of the piece. So it can be divided into some sort of mathematical context. You know, there is rhythm to it, but it's different every time it's performed. And silence, too. I find sometimes I can't listen to music while I design. I have to turn it off. But it depends on my mood. I know as a musician that music controls me a lot. If I let it in, it can let me do lots of different things. And sometimes the absence of music does the exact same thing.
That kind of hit on something similar. I was thinking of like one of the main reasons I listen to the types of music I listen to when I'm working, like trance and stuff, is because I deliberately listen to things that don't have a vocal track. Because the talking and the singing is very distractive, but an ambient beat in the background I can work over, especially while I'm coding.
Awesome. Brian.
I was wondering what cultures you guys draw from, like world cultures you draw from for inspiration. Like, as Dan knows, I'm a big Japanese freak, so
what cultures do y'all draw from, if any, specifically? Okay, that's good. Good question, Brian. Good question. The panel let us down.
He stumped the panel.
Damn. Right on time.
I tend to think of it as more global than specific to any particular culture. I like looking at all kinds of things.
Very cool.
It's kind of a non-answer.
Brian, I think you might have to come to lunch with us and like bug everybody to get more direct answers to it. Good job. And actually, because we're just about to wrap up here, everybody's ready to leave. So a couple of things. Let's see. Who is it? We had Brian ask a question. Who's the gentleman who asked the music question?
Charlie.
That was awesome. Where'd he go?
The
Right there. Okay, that's one, that's two. And first question out of the bat was from, where were you? Did you leave? Who asked the first question? All the way in the back? Okay, the three of you get a copy of, this is hot off the presses. I'm not even sure that all the authors have gotten a chance to see it yet. Since this is an art-related panel, there's a new book from SitePoint called The Art and Science of CSS. We actually have two or three of the authors in the room here if you can want to find them and get them to sign. But, so we've got three. I've got three copies of this book. The three of you come up and see me as soon as we're done here, and you'll get a copy of these. It's excellent books. I got to technical review it, so like I read the whole thing, and it's actually good. No, I'm way too sarcastic for this room. So the three of you see me right up here as we're done, and you'll get these copies. Thank you for your great questions. Thank you all very much. Before the applause, we're going to Moonshine for lunch. Everybody know where Moonshine is?
Between here and I-35.
Between here and I-35. It's like out the main door and take a right, yeah. And then another right. Okay, so if you want to come with us and ask questions and everything, that'd be great. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you.